Mark Summers is an icon to a generation or two. You may know him from his time hosting Nickelodeon's Double Dare and Food Network's Unwrapped, or as the producer of hits like Dinner Impossible and Restaurant Impossible. But through his new show at the Adirondack Theater Festival, you get a chance to meet the real Mark Summers, a man who has had a fascinating life of fame and frustration. The show has a great title, Everything in Its Place, The Life and Slimes of Mark Summers. It is a guided tour through Mark's life, from an early obsession with magic to his notable TV career to his appearance on Oprah announcing his ongoing battle with OCD. Mark stars in the tell-all about his life, his disorder, and taking the physical challenge. The show opens August 10th and runs through the 13th, and we are joined by the man himself, Mark Summers. Good morning, sir.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
We have no time left after all that, do we?
It's good to see you. We have plenty of time. And we also welcome the director of the show, as well as the producing artistic director of the Adirondack Theater Festival, Chad Rabinowitz. Chad, good morning. How are you?
Living the dream.
You know, when we had you on a couple of weeks ago and you were talking about the kickoff to the season, I was a little biased. This was the show I was most excited about. I was excited about all of your shows, but I was really excited about this show.
You've got good taste.
Yes. So how did this remind us how this came about?
Oh, well, Mark and I guess, met about a year and a half ago. Yep. When the script was under development, and I heard that there was a Mark Summers script floating around from Alex Brightman from School of Rock.
Guy who stars in School of Rock.
Yeah, Tony-nominated.
Yes,
Alex Brightman.
Nominated.
I legally have to say that every time now. But he and Drew Gasparini, who wrote some of the music in this show, we were working on another show, and they brought this one up, and I said, yep, I'm in.
So simple as that.
Simple as that.
Okay, so Mark Summers, how long has this show been around? Have you thought of doing this kind of thing?
Almost 6 years.
Wow.
And it proves how long something like this takes to come together. I was doing Grease out in a place called Long Beach Island, New Jersey, at a place called the Surflight Theater, and I met Drew Gasparini, who was all of 24 years old, and gave him this idea. He then introduced me to Alex Brightman, and for about 3 years, we'd go to dinner 4 or 5 times a year, and they would just ask me questions. And then about a year or so ago, almost 2 years ago now, they threw a script at me and said, we're going to do a reading in New York in December, and then we're going to do this for real. And it scared the heck out of me.
And it was always the desire, I would think, for you to actually be in it, to say, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, you know, it started off as more of a sort of a variety thing, and it became fun and entertaining and somewhat serious because if you've lived as long as I have, and I hope you all get to that point, I'll be 65 this year, and stuff happens that you certainly can't plan for.
Now, you wrote a book, I remember, right around 1999, 2000.
You're right.
Right on this. And this was basically talking about your OCD and coming to terms with that. And I believe it has the same title as this, correct?
Everything in Its Place is what it's called. And we've now added the Life and Slimes for the show. But yeah, that was, you know, difficult to write, needless to say, because you sort of pour your guts out. And the next thing I know, I'm talking to Howard Stern, Matt Lauer, and Oprah Winfrey about it and exposed it. And even as early as, you know, 1999, 2000, it was sort of a career-killing situation. I was involved with many things that sort of stopped because people were sort of scared.
So was it the and this is what I find fascinating. It wasn't the disorder itself that was career-stopping. It was the fact that you said you had the disorder. Is that, am I right on that?
Yeah, and I talk about that in our show, that you know, you can have a drug or an alcohol problem in L.A. or New York, and nobody really cares. But I was talking about, you know, something that had to do with your brain, about serotonin not getting from point A to point B. And for whatever reason, it scared the hell out of me. And I was going to be hosting the new Hollywood Squares. And then all these rumors started around about how I was difficult to work with and I was nuts. None of them were true, but, you know, these things started happening. And we talk about in the show, you know, all of a sudden that opportunity disappeared. And, you know, now down the road at 2016, things have changed dramatically. But initially, it was rough to deal with.
What went into the decision to go public with it, to say, this is what I have and this is what's going on?
Oh, wow. That's a major part of the show. I was hosting a talk show on Lifetime TV, And a doctor came in who was an expert on OCD, and I didn't know what I had. I just knew I thought I was nuts. And when I read the information the night before in my bedroom, I went, oh, my God, this thing I've been doing, it has a name. And so I went on a live TV show, my own talk show, the next day and sort of spilled my guts and said, I think I have this. So I didn't have too much time to think about it other than the fact I could have lied and said I don't, but I told the truth and said I did. And the phone started ringing like, I think you just made the biggest mistake in your entire career, and initially it was.
What was it? I mean, the irony here, of course, is that you have OCD, and then your career is basically getting green stuff poured on you every night.
The messiest game show on television. Yep.
So in my mind, that has to suck, right?
No. No, you know, everybody says that. And there's always...
Well, you'd think it would be the end of the turmoil of, oh my God, I have this, and then they're torturing me every night.
Well, but see, I never looked at it as torture. You know, my biggest passion in life was to host a TV game show. From the time I was 6 years old, that's all I really wanted to do. So now I get this great opportunity, and then I say to myself, okay, you finally got what you wanted. And in the rehearsals, they never used any of the green slime or whipped cream or that stuff. I walk on the set the first day, and they're pouring, you know, whipped cream and chocolate syrup all over the slide. And I said, what are they doing there? Well, it's part of the obstacle course. I didn't know what the hell was about to happen. So it was kind of a mind over matter situation where I got my dream. I'm not going to screw it up. But Nickelodeon can tell you, and the producers, the minute the camera was off, I would start taking my clothes off in front of the audience. And they would say, well, can you wait? Because, you know, it's 300 kids, 6 to 10.
Yeah.
And the executives would say, well, can you wait till we get back to the dressing room? And I'd go, no, I can't, you know. So it was weird.
Is it when you think about that, of what you did, because ultimately – you were a game show host.
Yeah.
I mean, you were a game show host for a really long time to kids. I mean, did you have, you mentioned Hollywood Squares. I mean, did you have, was the dream to be that sort of Bill Cullen, Gene Rayburn type?
Oh, I love you, the fact that you even know who those people are. Yeah, that was the dream. Back in the day.
Our dreams are similar, by the way. Yeah, go ahead.
Cool. You know, back in the day when I would be sick from you know, school and I'd stay home, NBC, CBS, ABC all had game shows on. So you would start at 9 in the morning and watch, you know, Price is Right and Jeopardy and all these programs.
Right.
And I went, oh, I want to do that. And my first job in television was writing for a show called Truth or Consequences the last year Bob Barker did it.
Yeah.
And I went, well, I'm done. I've died and gone to heaven. There's nothing else I need to do.
Now, see, Bob Barker is a great host.
Mm-hmm.
Gene Rayburn was a great host.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Cullen was a great host.
Amazing.
Gary Moore was a great host.
Yep.
But now we don't have game show hosts per se anymore. Pat Sajak and Alex Trebek, sure, they're game show hosts.
Mm-hmm.
But now, mostly, especially with this new run, you have actors. You have Alec Baldwin. You have Michael Strahan. You have people of different stripes. Mostly, a lot of comedians that come in and do it. But they miss out on what it actually is to be a broadcaster and to be a host.
Man, you just like you're in my Hall of Fame now. The term broadcaster isn't used anymore.
No, we don't use it.
They don't use that. But see, I remember growing up and seeing Hugh Downs do the Today Show.
That's right.
And then walk down the hall and do Concentration. Well, all of a sudden, some executives got involved and said, well, he can't do that. At one time when I was hosting Double Dare, I was also doing Hard News on a show called The Home Show on ABC.
Oh, well, that's right.
And the network executive said, get him off the air because he can't be throwing green liquids at 11-year-olds and then talking about the polyclass kidnapping. And there was an exec producer, Woody Fraser, who literally cleared a desk and said, I love this guy, I'm sticking with him, okay? Because the term broadcaster, if you can talk to kids and throw green liquids, you should also be able to do the other thing. And that's what makes me nuts about the fact that, I won't mention names, but some of the names that might have been mentioned earlier who don't have any experience, but because they were a reality star or did something on a national sports team are now hosting shows. And if you go to agents, be it William Morris or CAA or wherever you go, they say, well, they don't want...
That's all right.
Good God, I thought everything was turned off. My phone's great.
That's okay.
They say they don't want hosty hosts. And so guys who were actual game show hosts are referred to as hosty hosts. Well, I don't know what that means because Bill Cullen certainly had a great career. with all due respect to Alec Baldwin, Gene Rayburn was the king of that show. And, you know, Barker is Barker. You know, it's hard to top that. Does Drew Carey do a good job? I guess so. The show's still on the air. He was a stand-up comic who became a sitcom star who became a game show host. Does he understand how the game works, and is he as good as Barker? No. But, you know, the audience seems to like him, so good for them. It's a different world.
Well, when you talk to somebody like Bob Barker, who I've had the opportunity to do so, and it's fascinating because he'll tell you about the difference of hosting Truth or Consequences to hosting
Price
is Right, and then also even Alex Trebek will tell you about what it is like in actual hosting the game. It's the mechanics. They very much know the game. They know what it is to do the game, and then also to entertain an audience and to be that presence and to be a host and to be a broadcaster.
Because we were trained that way, and the way Barker was discovered, he was doing radio in Los Angeles, and Ralph Edwards, who was doing a show called This Is Your Life, heard him on the radio, brought him in and handed over Truth or Consequences because Ralph was doing it and wanted to move on to other things. So the training was he was a broadcaster on the radio first and then transitioned into television. But those sort of farm clubs don't happen anymore. And I produce TV shows now, and I refuse to see anybody who's been on a reality show. And the agents hate me, but it's, you know, I'm
well,
sorry.
Good for you.
I don't
good
do
for
it.
You.
I mean, just because you won The Amazing Race doesn't give you permission to start hosting shows now, in my mind, you know? So I just don't see those people.
So we don't use the term broadcaster anymore, but you consider yourself a broadcaster.
Absolutely. Letterman used that term. I use that term. You use that term. I don't know anybody else who does anymore.
Yeah. And the idea would be to, so now, I mean, obviously you have the show out, so yep. Then you become, so you do the opposite thing. You become a game show host who becomes an actor, which is kind of a nice way of screwing
over
that.
Oh, I don't think I'm an actor. Chad will tell you that. I think I got a little bit lucky because I met Drew, who then turned me on to Alex, and because of some connections in the entertainment industry, I got this opportunity. I got a long way to go to be an actor, and I learn stuff every day. Chad, as the director, has taught me so much, and we did it first in Bloomington, Indiana for 3 weeks, and now we're doing it here. And so I think the show from there to here has gotten amazingly strong. Not that it wasn't strong initially, but, you know, come back in a year or two when I even have more stage time, and I think it's going to be even better. This acting thing is a tough road, I got to tell you. I'm an emotional ball of jelly, and I cry constantly in rehearsals, as they'll tell you, and it's a tough job.
So is it just you on stage?
Pretty much. There's a little secret that I'm not going to tell you.
Okay, that's all right.
Pretty much just me.
Okay. And Chad, what has it been like to direct this guy?
I'm leaving now.
Are we still on the air?
Yeah.
Okay. No, you know, what's interesting is that it couldn't be more opposite from the scenario of what Mark was saying, that there's reputation back when OCD came out about being difficult to work with. You know, I've done over 100 of these by now, and one of the most enjoyable experiences in my career has been working on this show. Collaborating with Mark is an absolute joy, and Alex and Drew as well. So this is one of those unique shows where it has been every step of the way just utterly fulfilling.
I often say, look, I don't know what I'm talking about here, and I've never done that much theater, so teach me, guide me, help me. And that's what I've been getting from this whole process. And it is a process, you know. It's sort of a workshop, constantly moving. And, you know, I learn things on stage every night.
And that's the big difference between Mark and a lot of others. He came in wanting to learn and to get better, and the show has grown and gotten so much better. Rather than, you never know when you're dealing with a celebrity. I mean, I certainly grew up with Mark, and he is that icon that you described in the beginning. And so to have someone also be open to my point of view throughout this process it's just been incredible.
What do you think is, I mean, do you understand how people perceive you because you were omnipresent in their life for so long?
For a particular generation or two, and the generation that started with me has been nice enough to follow me over to Food Network, first on Unwrapped and then on the other stuff. You know, this word icon, all of a sudden, for some reason, this year has been tossed around a lot. I don't know what that word means. I certainly don't think of myself as an icon. I was in the right place at the right time. When I was growing up, there was a guy by the name of Soupy Sales, and I idolized him, and he was the iconic kids show host.
Yes.
I never wanted to be a kids show host. I just wanted to host TV shows. So for whatever reason, the magic was there. It was Nickelodeon. It was launching. My career was launching. It was mess. Kids didn't have their own game show. It was on at 5:30 at night before mom served dinner. So it was a lot of right place, right time things. But there's a line in the show about, I believe in being in the right place at the right time, but also being believe in being prepared to be in the right place at the right time. And I am. I was in the right place at the right time then, but it I was almost 34 when that happened, so you paid dues prior to that.
Sure.
And then when the producing thing happened, I was in the right place in the right time for that, and the same thing for this show. You know, my dream is I got one thing left on the bucket list. I want to do a show on Broadway. Is it this show? God, I hope so. I'd be happy with off-Broadway. But that's kind of the thing. You know, I always wanted to host a show. I wanted to produce a show. I wanted to do this. I wanted to do that. I've been knocking things off. But if somehow I can get this thing into New York City, that would be amazing.
Were you a page?
Yes, at CBS Television City. Worked on Sonny and Cher and All in the Family and things like that. Yeah, Carol Burnett.
Did you do any of the game shows?
Yeah, I worked on Price. I was a head page on Match Game with Rayburn.
So you were in the studio when that happened.
Oh, I was in the studio with all that stuff. Yeah, I was Joker's Wild was the first show I worked on.
Jack Barry
was the first guy to hire me, first guy to fire me.
Why did he fire me?
that's not in the show.
That's
because you could bring.
I'll give you the Cliff Notes version.
Because he wasn't a clean slate, was he? I mean, he had his issues.
You know what? He's a very sweet man. He had his rough times. If you want to do the homework, but yeah. He ended up to be a really sweet man. Besides, you know, you try to get your career going. I wanted to be a stand-up comic, but I was doing professional magic at a place called the Magic Castle, and I was doing warm-ups on Joker. And Joker was running late, and I had a 7 o'clock show at the Magic Castle. And Johnny Jacobs, who was the real announcer on that show, I said, Johnny, I can't do the last applause break. I have to go and do this show. Will you cover me? He said yes. I went and did the show. My phone rang that night from the exec producer saying, where the hell were you? And I said, I told Johnny. Well, Johnny Jacobs, although he should rest in peace, lied and said I didn't say anything to him. So I got fired the next day. I walked in, and Jack said, this is your last day. Get out of here, okay? The weird thing was, about 10 years later, when I was like the king of warm-ups in Los Angeles, the regular warm-up guy on the syndicated version of Joker's Wild couldn't make it, and they called me in, and I was scared to death to go back, but I decided to do it, and I said, I'm not going to talk to Jack, and I was walking by his dressing room, and he said, come on in here, Mark. I was shaking in my boots, and he couldn't have been nicer, and there was a turning point there. But yeah, I mean, things happen for a reason, and to know those guys and to work with Barker and to work with Rayburn and you know, I was the head page on a show called Tattletales. With Bert Convy, who was a sort of a mentor to me.
Yeah.
And Bill Cullen and his wife, Ann, were on that show. And so to be in the same studio with Cullen, who was like the dean of game shows, he hosted, you know, he went off of one show and went right to the next. I was in awe of those people.
All right. So, Mark, where did they put the spouses when they're on Tattletales?
Oh.
Where the hell did they put them?
In the soundproof room. They were just in a holding area that had, you know, cameras there.
Yeah, the little TV.
Do you remember those stupid headphones?
Yeah, they looked dumb.
Yeah, yeah. Really looked ridiculous when they did that.
But a successful show.
Yeah, fun. That lasted 3 or 4 years. And the reason that show was successful, forget about Convy and all that stuff, is that was the first time they actually paid the audience, that they divided the audience up into three sections. And if your section won, they would hand out checks to you as you walked out the door. So standing room only as the head page.
Why would you not want to go there?
And some people, you know, you could walk off with $56 or something, but... Yeah, I could tell you amazing stories of being a page, let me tell you. Working with Norman Lear and people like that.
Norman Lear, of course. Was he doing, you were doing
the... I was the first page on the pilot of Good Times.
Which was, of course...
Jimmy Walker.
But the spinoff to All in the Family.
All in the Family. And there were many spinoffs from All in the Family.
Yes.
So I will tell you the story, and I ran into Mr. Lear not long ago and reminded him of the story, because he was one of the sweetest guys in the world.
Yeah.
Think when the show was on, 1973 is when we did the pilot.
Yes.
Okay. And so they felt the only people who would watch that show would be people who were black, which made no sense back then. So they asked to bring in an entire black audience, and the show was running late in rehearsal. And they were waiting for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and the audience was getting restless. And Norman Lear came out and handed me a wad of bills and said, tell all these people I'm going to give them $10, go next door to Farmer's Market and have dinner, and then come back. And I said, Mr. Lear, with all due respect, these people have been waiting in line for $3. I start handing out money. They ain't coming back. So he said, why? And I said, because they're restless. You can't keep people standing in line for 3 hours, yeah. Tell them to go dinner and then come back. They ain't coming back. And about half of them did. We did the pilot and the show was on for a few years. But, I mean, to have those experiences, you know, to meet Barker, to go to Carol Burnett's Christmas party and have Lyle Wagner try to pick up my wife, you know, I mean, I can tell you all sorts of great stories.
That happened to you too?
Yes. As a matter of fact,
Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, I worked on Here's Lucy, okay? And one day Desi Arnaz was shooting a pilot and he came on the set. And
they had obviously been split at that point, right?
Well, yeah, they were divorced for years. Yeah. And Gary Morton, who hated Desi, was like pacing back and forth when he saw Desi walk out. Well, Desi walks out, and the whole audience gives a standing ovation. There's Ricky and Lucy again. And, you know, he says with his bad accent, you know, I always love Lucy. And it was a moment that you can't duplicate, you know?
And you work with Gail Gordon?
I did work with Gail Gordon a few times, who was the most consummate professional in the history of show business.
That's very cool.
Lucille. Yeah.
So let me ask you about Match Game for a second, because you're on that show.
Yep.
You were Paige on that show.
Head Paige on that show. Right.
The story of that
it's
of Match
true.
Game is.
You're, I know what you're going to ask me. That's true.
What am I going to ask?
That they drink during the breaks.
Absolutely. So they start the show. They start taping like 10, and then by the time. About 6:37, they're blasted.
Well, no. We would shoot like from 12 to 3.
Yep.
Three shows.
Okay.
Take an hour and a half dinner break.
And then
during
they're
that dinner
blasted.
Break is when they'd be drinking. The last two shows, holy cow. Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Charles Nelson Reilly was nuts enough. Put a few, you know, glasses
in
him.
Put a few drinks
him. Oh, my God.
In Charles Nelson Reilly and God. Brett Summers and...
You
stir,
know.
Mix, and enjoy, right?
And Gene Rayburn, I remember once his mother came to the show.
Oh,
okay, I'm just honest got truth. So I'm backstage in the dressing room, and he says, hey, Mark, can you take my mother down to the audience? And I said, sure, Gene, no problem. And he said, make sure when you take her there, you don't grab her ass. Okay? That's what Gene Rayburn said to me.
Really?
Yeah, was nuts. It was crazy.
And you didn't.
Well, I'm not going to tell you if I did or not. But
come to the show.
But he was a nice man.
He was. You know what? He was an extremely brilliant man. When you think about his career, okay, this guy was the announcer on the Tonight Show.
Yes.
Okay, that number one. Okay, then. He filled in when...
He also started as a page.
He started as a page, okay.
Yes, for NBC.
Absolutely. But when Dick Van Dyke left Bye Bye Birdie on Broadway, Gene Rayburn took his place, okay? So Gene had all this experience, and when I was a kid on NBC, there was a thing called Monitor. It was radio on the weekends that had people like Ed McMahon and Bill Cullen and Gene... And I would drive around on Saturdays with my mom and just couldn't wait to listen to Monitor. And so Gene always felt at the end, I tried to get a hold of him and talk to him, and he was really angry and sort of hostile and bitter at the end, because he always thought, and justifiably so, that he should have been a bigger star than he was.
Yeah.
And he was quite brilliant. You know, never got the recognition. You know, Barker always gets the pats on the back, but I have tons of Barker stories. So,
when do we turn into a pumpkin? When do you have to leave? You have to leave in like 5 minutes?
Oh, 5 minutes or so.
Okay, yeah. All right.
I'm having so much fun here.
No, I know. I don't want you to go. I have a million questions I have to ask you. So one time I'm interviewing Bob Barker, and mm-hmm. I go down, and I'm in Television City in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and I interview Bob Barker, and then they come in and they say, oh, 10 minutes, Mr. Barker, and he starts to get ready. And I'm doing the interview, and I kind of follow him around with a microphone. I'm talking to him, and all of a sudden he drops his pants, mm-hmm. and I see the full Barker,
mm-hmm.
which is really
just... You too, huh?
Well, yeah, which is really disturbing, but he for the next 10 minutes, he's just walking around and everything's, you know, swinging away. And it's like, all right, well, there you go. And you sort of want to be dead, right?
You too?
Yeah. Well, that's the question.
Why?
So it is, well, is that an, let me ask it this way.
Mm-hmm.
That story I just told you, mm-hmm. does that fit into the guy with the guy you know?
No, not at all.
Really?
No, I know. Let's just tell you this. When I was doing Truth or Consequences in 1973, 1974,
okay.
Watergate was going on.
Yeah.
Okay? And Barker was the biggest staunch supporter of Richard Nixon. And we didn't have a cafeteria. We had a food truck. And I remember going out to the food truck with Barker and him bitching and complaining about how dare they do this to the greatest president in the history of the world, okay? And I can also tell you that Dorothy Jo, his wife, used to make fudge, and Bob used to walk around with a platter, and we had to eat Dorothy Jo's fudge. He was, still is, we're talking like he's gone, complicated, strange, interesting man. Collaborative? Hardly.
Okay, well, it seems then the story I told you perfectly fits into what
you're
saying.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Maybe as towards the end he didn't care.
He just didn't care.
Yeah.
It was just a little off. He was Bob Barker. He had the show. He could pretty much do what he wants.
Well, and that was his attitude. You know,
yeah.
On his door it said WGMC, World's Greatest MC. He had it monogrammed on his shirts, and he believed it, okay? And I think the problem is when you get to that point when you start to believe it, there's issues, you know? People call me iconic. I kind of laugh and turn the other way. Bob actually believes it. So I think therein the problem lies.
So you go, you do the show. It's playing at the Adirondack Theater Festival from August 10th through the 13th, and it's called Everything in Its Place, The Life and Slimes of Mark Summers. And is it, how long is this thing?
It's about 90 minutes.
90 minutes?
Yeah.
You're on stage for almost.
I'm on stage pretty much by myself for an hour and a half,
I will tell you, it is one of the most entertaining and moving, funny, fun shows that you'll ever see. I mean, it is wholly different than any theater experience I've had.
Well, I can't wait to see this. It's Everything in Its Place, The Life and Slimes of Mark Summers, and it's at the Adirondack Theater Festival. You can find out more information by going to atfestival.org, atfestival.org. It's August 10th through the 13th. And, you've had quite a career, my friend. And
it's been fun.
I thank you very much for sharing aspects of it with us.
Yeah, and after we turn these mics off, I'm going to tell you more.
I can't wait. All right. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.